It's the morning show. I'm Shereen Siewert in for Kate Archer-Kent. The Wisconsin Department of Health Services announced this month that 14 nonprofit dental clinics will receive grant funding to increase access to dental care statewide over a period of 3 years. So how will clinics make the best use of those funds to reach the patients who need it most? Call in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Lisa Hintz is the Community Outreach Director for Tri-County Dental Clinic in Appleton. Welcome to the Ideas Network, Lisa.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, you're one of 14 dental clinics that were recently awarded a grant by the State Health Department. Take me through this. Did your organization have to apply for the grant, or were you just chosen? What happened?
Well, there was an application that was completed. And so, yes, the Department of Health Services let people know that the funding opportunity was available, and people could apply for that. And then you, as part of that application, you had to indicate how you were going to use the funds to try and increase access to care, and specifically to dental oral health care. So yes, that application was completed, and we were very excited to receive the award notification that we were chosen as one of the clinics to receive some funding.
So are there some guidelines on how you have to use the money? I mean, do you have to follow what you put in your application? How does that work?
Yes, and there are, so we have to put a work plan together along with the budget, and then there are check-in reports that will have to be completed. So yes, you definitely need to have the follow-through to make sure that you are following the steps that you've laid out.
Sure. So those kinds of accountability factors are in there. We're talking about accessible dental care with Lisa Hintz. She's Community Outreach Director for Tri-County Dental Clinic in Appleton. So what do you plan to use the grant for?
Well, at Tri-County Dental, one of the things that's really unique about our clinic, Shereen, is that we are run predominantly, or the care is provided predominantly by volunteer dentists.
Oh.
So we have a paid staff of hygienists and dental assistants and people like myself. But the dentists are predominantly volunteers. So this is our 20th year of existence, and we still have the founders of Tri-County Dental who are so generous in the time they give to providing that care. And we also have a really, really strong collaboration and partnership with Marquette Dental School and NWTC and Fox Valley Tech to provide students who do rotations through the clinic. So part of our goal with this grant is to help staffing capacity, truly, because you can't provide the care if you don't have the trained dental staff, right?
Right.
So one of the things that we're doing in this summer is we also have, through the Marquette Dental School, right now, currently, we have one fellow. So what a fellow is a recent dental school graduate. So they are a dentist, mm-hmm. But they take a year and they commit to providing that year of employment with Tri-County Dental, and it helps give them really, really strong hands-on experience. And this year, we're going to have two fellows. So part of this grant is going to help us be able to provide the salaries to have those two fellows. And the goal with having two fellows, Shereen, is to be able to put more time with dentists on our mobile clinic. That's the other thing that's oh. so unique about Tri-County Dental. We understand the importance of removing barriers to care for struggling working families and for parents. So a lot of the kids that we see through our Robert Glass Focus on the Children program, we see at their school on the mobile clinic. So we drive the mobile clinic to their school, and if they qualify and are eligible, they can receive a dental exam on the mobile clinic. They can receive a hygiene cleaning on the clinic. And our goal with this grant is also to increase the ability to go back to those schools to provide restorative care. And restorative care, on the mobile clinic tends to be mostly the fillings, right? Mm-hmm. So we go for the exams and the hygiene, and there's a lot of decay that's detected. We make notes. But just, again, due to capacity, it's been a challenge to bring the mobile clinic back to provide that restore. There's only so many school days too. So in trying to reach all of the schools and all of the kids who are in those schools to do the exam days with the bite wing x-rays and the dentist doing this, the, you know, peeking in the mouth and providing fluoride treatments and sealants and so on and so forth, you know, then trying to schedule a return visit to do the restorative care has been challenging. So we're going through some process improvement, trying to find efficiencies so that we can see more kids and complete the circle of care so that they can miss less school. Really tough. Oral health decay is one of the number one reasons kids miss school.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. How do you screen children to find out that they are eligible for this? I mean, is there a financial criteria or an insurance-based
yes.
criteria?
Yes, there is. So we partner with our school districts who use our services, and I have to give a shout out to the contacts at the school, because boy, they work really hard to make sure that we're able to provide this care. So what we do is we provide them with information about what the Robert Glass Focus on the Children program is, what the eligibility criteria are, which you can't have other private health or dental health insurance, low income status. So we provide all that information to them, and then they distribute it to their families at their school, along with a consent form. And if somebody wants to be a part of the program, then they fill out the consent form. We screen by going to like the Forward Health website to make sure there is there Medicaid, or is it just that there is no insurance and that there's the low income criteria that are that is being met. So yes, they definitely need to fit those criteria in order to be a part of the program.
Lisa, do you have a sense of how much of a need there is for children? I mean, with your mobile clinic, is the need significant?
Very significant. There is a great need, and part of the issue is that, you know, a lot of these kids are, you know, the parents have Medicaid, which provides an incredibly low reimbursement rate. So most private dental practices really are challenged to be able to provide care to people who don't have mm-hmm. private insurance or the income level to be able to pay on their own. So that's what the other thing that's unique about Tri-County Dental, of course, is that's why, because of having the volunteer dentist helping to provide care, that's part of how our area helps bridge that gap, so to speak. But yes, the need is great. We also, Tri-County Dental, our fixed site clinic in Appleton is the only clinic that has urgent emergent care that is provided to adults. So unfortunately, again, because of the capacity issue, there are adults in our area who need preventative oral health care.
Oh, sure.
But there just isn't a way to provide that. So when they have tooth pain or tooth concern, we have a walk-in clinic, and they can come in and register. And again, the predominant solution to that is an extraction. So what's amazing to me is when I first joined Tri-County last year, to see people coming through the clinic with the, you know, the big chunk of gauze in their mouth from having had an extraction, and a smile on their face, because they don't have pain.
Oh,
so
yeah.
The pain relief of that is just incredible. But yeah, there's a video that the Department of Health Services put out that said that in 2021, 7 out of 10 Medicaid members did not get dental care.
Wow.
So 7 out of 10, 70%. So that means that, and even for the 3 to 20-year-old age range, only 1 in 3 received any kind of preventive service. And that's a critical time frame. That 3 to 20 years old is a critical time frame to protect those teeth, especially the 6-year molars, so that they can last a lifetime. That was one of the
right.
questions I asked when I first joined the clinic. How long are teeth really supposed to last? a lifetime. You should have your teeth for your lifetime.
Lisa Hintz is the Community Outreach Director for Tri-County Dental Clinic in Appleton. She'll stay with us. You can call in 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Siewert. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Siewert. Our discussion on grants to improve access to dental care in Wisconsin continues. Have you struggled to find dental care for yourself or for a family member? Call in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Lisa Hintz is the Community Outreach Director for Tri-County Dental Clinic in Appleton. Lisa, the State Health Department says grant awards are meant to address the dental disparity in Wisconsin. So talk a little bit about how that disparity is reflected in the patients who visit your clinic.
Well, there is definitely a disparity. And of course, the obvious thing is, there's the income that prevents people from getting the care that they need. And truly, one of the stats that I've seen provided by DHS is that there are one in five children who have untreated tooth decay, and African-American children are nearly twice as likely as white children to have untreated tooth decay. So we see that with what we track and the ethnicity of the folks we see and the income levels of the folks we see. And I want to also point out what's a challenge is some of the automatic judgment that comes, because when you see people who have dental issues, we'll say, the smile on someone's face is the first thing you notice about them. And people respond and react with pretty harsh judgments as a result of that.
Sure.
So it's sort of that perpetuating issue then. If you don't have access to the care and you have the issues, but then you also don't have anyone available to help treat and provide that relief. Even the ability from the kids' perspective to get to a clinic or to find a provider who is willing to see patients who are on Medicaid, it's a huge challenge for people in our community. And I think that's very surprising in the Fox Cities in particular. I think it's very surprising to our community members at how great the need is and mm-hmm. how little availability there is.
Why is that, though? I mean, can you explain that? Why is it so hard for people who have Medicaid to find a dentist that will treat them?
Well, really, the incredibly low reimbursement rate. So, and in January of 2022, there was a 40% increase in the Medicaid reimbursement rate, which sounds really exciting, but that increase brought it up to 28%. So when you're a dental clinic, obviously you're running a business and you have to meet your expenses and so on and so forth. A 28% reimbursement rate is kind of a challenging level.
Sure.
So I think that's a big part of it. I think it's just that you can't keep your doors open while having so little to cover the cost. So that's, I know the plea right now is for dentists to consider having at least a portion, like to agree to a portion of the services they provide being given to Medicaid patients.
We're talking
Again,
about
that's why that I'm sorry, that's why the dentists who founded Tri-County Dental, they were seeing such a disparity in the care provided to folks and said we need to do something. We need to address this.
We're talking about accessible dental care with Lisa Hintz. She is the Community Outreach Director for Tri-County Dental Clinic in Appleton. Lisa, it's so interesting to hear all of these perspectives because, it's not something that we always think about. We have Bonnie with us from La Crosse. Good morning, Bonnie. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for having me. My comment is that I'm appalled at what I'm hearing, and we all know that we walk into a service providing retailer and we will have people waiting on us who have no teeth at all. Poor dental care that we evidently as a First Nation cannot provide for our people, like for instance Norway, where they have free, meaning tax supported care for their children. I have a cousin who has a hunting lodge, and Americans hunt there. And he was appalled that he noticed that some Americans were taking their teeth out to brush them. They don't have that normally. And they have much better health. So that's my comment.
Okay. That we have failed. Thank you, Bonnie. Before. Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. I guess what's your reaction to what Bonnie said, Lisa?
It's very true. Excuse me. And there's also the fact that, you know, we've learned over the years how critical your oral health care is to your overall health. Mm-hmm. You know, the health of your mouth is important to your overall health. There's a lot of connections in ties. And given the fact that we now know that, I have to say that that's been a startling thing to me as I grew up, honestly, that dental insurance and oral health care is separate from overall health and health insurance. Mm-hmm. And I never understood that. I'm like, but it's part of my overall health. That should be health insurance.
Right. Right. I know my son just had a bunch of work done and first time as an adult having to pay for it himself. And he was like, what? You know what I mean?
It can be a little shocking. Well, and even to the point, again, with our focus being on children, it's not even, you know, I referenced the stat that it's the number one reason kids miss school. So chronic absenteeism because of tooth pain. But even if kids aren't missing school, but if they're in school and still have tooth pain, what's their ability to concentrate and truly to be present to learn? All of that is impacted. So it affects the trajectory of your success in life, right? So it has such a huge implication for your future. And even what the caller just said about service workers and the, again, self-confidence. How do I feel about myself? We want to bring healthy, happy smiles to kids so they can feel good about sports, so they can present themselves in a confident manner.
A press release from the Wisconsin Department of Health Services says the grants won't fix the disparity alone. I mean, in your view, what else can be done to help your clinic and other clinics address these oral health disparities? What would you like to see happen?
Oh, I would, and this is just me personally, I'm going to say what I would love to see happen is that A, either the Medicaid reimbursement rate is greatly increased, or B, that we look at how do we bundle our insurance better to truly cover the things that will make an impact on the overall health of our community.
Sandy from Appleton called in, could not stay with us, but she asked why grants are needed instead of raising fees for reimbursement. She said, you know, that way, Sandy says, more dentists can take Medicaid. What do you think about that?
I think that's a fabulous question. Unfortunately, I don't know the answer as to why, other than, of course, you have state, you know, they obviously have the challenge of balancing a budget for themselves. So, you know, there's competing priorities for state budget. So optional adult dental benefits are often not provided or very limited. So, you know, as a community of the state of Wisconsin, talk to your representatives about what you believe is important to be funding.
When you look ahead and you're getting this grant money, I mean, do you feel like it's going to really make a difference in the number of people that you serve?
We are planning for that, absolutely. And not just the grant, but as I said, even some of the process improvements and encouraging more dentists to participate with the mobile clinics so that we can get back to the schools. And then we rely so much on partnerships and collaborations, both with Marquette University for their School of Dentistry program, because they have dental students who rotate through and help provide care, and then our volunteer dentists. So yes, all of that needs to come into play. And this grant, as I said, will help us pay for an additional fellow so that we have regular full-time fellows who can provide care on the mobile clinic as well. Most of our volunteer dentists volunteer for 4-hour shifts. So they'll do the morning shift or the afternoon shift. When we go out on the mobile clinic, it's more of like a 6-hour shift. So that's where the fellow is really going to be able to help provide additional care on the mobile clinic to the schools and bring our oral health care st- services to kids where they are.
Well, Lisa, I want to thank you so much for joining us and sharing this news with us. It's been a really fascinating conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Lisa Hintz, the Community Outreach Director for Tri-County Dental Clinic in Appleton. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward. In 1978, the Indian Child Welfare Act created minimum federal standards for placing Native children in homes that would reflect the unique values of Indian culture. The law was challenged by the state of Texas and by non-Indian adoptive parents, and the U.S. Supreme Court handed down its decision this month. Join in this discussion, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Dehasi Hill is the chairman of the United Nation. Dehasi, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
So how are Native American families feeling about the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to uphold this 1978 Indian Child Welfare Act? What was the reaction?
Well, we were very excited. We're always, you know, hopeful, but reserved as Indian policy goes before the Supreme Court. And this particular one had, you know, longstanding history. Passed in 1978 and had very positive impact on tribal communities across the country.
Talk about that a little bit. Why was the Indian Child Welfare Act so important to tribes?
Well, you know, I guess it kind of a little bit more history around it. You know, Congress had studied the issue and reports came back from anywhere from 25 to 35% of all Native children were being removed from their homes. By both state agencies and nonprofits and things like that, adoption agencies. And so tribes have been fighting for keeping our language and our culture and our communities alive, and the removal of our children from our communities had a very detrimental effect on that stability.
So back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, before this was enacted, the children that were removed were being placed elsewhere. They were being placed in homes that were not Native?
Yeah, not Native, and a lot of times even out of the state.
So then this act guaranteed that right then?
It put, I guess, measures in place to be able to place children at a different, I guess, priority with Native within their community, their families, and other Native communities. So it doesn't necessarily block a transfer to a non-Native family, but it just put a priority list in place to be able to go down that list.
And okay. I want to point out that the court's decision leaves an unresolved question. That's whether the law's system of preferences for Native adoptive parents is an unconstitutional racial preference. Are you concerned that this issue could be brought to the courts again?
Yeah, that, you know, anytime it's unresolved by the Supreme Court, there's always a potential for that to come back. And so, you know, as we're strong in our stance that the relationship between Indian nations across the country and the federal government is that of a political one and not a racial one. So that's an argument that we continuously make in defense of these types of arguments.
The Supreme Court's majority opinion said 200 years of legal precedent has given Congress the right to legislate Indian affairs. How do you view the High Court's recognition of the longstanding government-to-government relationship between the U.S. and tribal nations?
Yeah, you know, that's one of the, you know, basic tenets around Indian policy, federal Indian policy, is that relationship. And we were very glad to see that the Supreme Court had relied on those that longstanding history and other court decisions that address this issue. And again, it's just the importance of that government-to-government relationship that tribes have with the federal government that's based on the Supreme, based on the Constitution, that treaties are made between two governments, and so, and treaties are the supreme law of the land, and that that continues to be upheld.
So tribes tend to, they interact with the federal government then on more political grounds?
Yes, correct.
Okay. Can we circle back to the act and the placement preferences for Native children? How does this go? If a child is taken into, is removed from the home, put into the system, where does the child get placed first?
With Oneida, it's, I guess we've also enacted, you know, our own family law and put specific placement preferences in place. So it could be slightly different for different tribes across the country. But in general, always checking with family first, relative and things like that. And then other tribal members in the community, other tribes, and so on. So it basically starts like a target with trying to place the child or children within the, you know, the bullseye would be within the family. But then if that's not possible, then the next ring out, the next ring out, the next ring out, and eventually to a non-tribal family.
Talk a little bit about why you think that's so important. I mean, why is it so important to keep children within the tribes, even to another tribe?
Yeah, you know, that's really an identity issue that, you know, we've been fighting the federal government and state governments on for since the beginning, I guess, that our language and our culture and our way of life and our way of thinking might not be the same as a non-Native family. And so trying to instill those views and our language and our culture in our children to carry that on is very important.
Tehasi Hill is the chairman of the Oneida Nation. Call in with your questions, your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward, discussing the U.S. Supreme Court's decision upholding the 1978 Indian Child Welfare Law with Tehasi Hill, the chairman of the Oneida Nation. Call in with your questions, your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. The Oneida Nation is one of five tribal nations in the country that intervened in this case. Why was the Oneida Nation involved? Why was this so important?
Yes, thank you for that question. I guess the Oneida Nation is, pretty sophisticated in our tribal programs and services that we provide to our tribal members. And we were kind of early adopters into the whole process, into, you know, family law and family court and things like that. And so having a long history of our active engagement in child welfare issues, I think, is one of the reasons we were asked to join the case.
I know we touched on this a little bit earlier today, but take us through Wisconsin history a little bit more and the issue of Native American children being separated from their tribes. Why was this happening in the first place?
Well, you know, it really goes back quite some time, with the federal government evolution of Indian policy through the hundreds of years has evolved to where we're at today. But basically, you know, it really had started out with the removal of Native people from their indigenous homelands to reservations. And then from there, there was a mindset about, kill the Indian, save the man. And so boarding schools were started across the country, and the removal of young Indian children from their homes and from their families and placed in these boarding schools for years and years, and had very little, if any, contact with their families until They were essentially released from this boarding school system. So a lot of times the children were adults by the time they were returning home and being subject to all types of abuses, both mental, physical, and sexual abuse in these boarding school systems. And then bringing that back home to their reservations had a very detrimental effect on our communities, and how children were raised from those points on was very difficult.
We're talking about the ruling this month from the U.S. Supreme Court that upheld the Indian Child Welfare Act with Oneida Nation Chairman Dehasi Hill. Despite this act and the protections within it, Native children in Wisconsin are still being removed from their tribal homes. The issue is happening in Brown County, Outagamie County, and that's where the Oneida Nation lies. So why are so many children still being separated from their families? Why are they being separated from the families now, even with this in place?
Yeah, I think it really is a systems issue, as foster homes and things like that are in high demand for not only Indian country, but American families in general. And so trying to find a placement within, you know, a family and within a community and within a tribal nation has become much more difficult, especially with the effects of the opioid epidemic that's been facing this country for quite some time now. And so these homes are becoming scarce to the need.
What kinds of tools are in place in the Oneida Nation for foster care? Do you have foster families?
Yeah, we have foster families. There's a lot of different programs in place, kind of respite care and things like that. And then also the ability to utilize our own healthcare systems. We have, primary health care through the Oneida Community Health Center. We have behavioral health programs as well to address some of the particular needs of an individual or families, what they go through with the different trauma that happens when children are removed from their families.
Do you see a need for more licensed foster care within the Oneida Nation?
Yes, definitely. That's it's always a need, and wherever and whenever we can, we speak of it and try to encourage individuals and families to open their home up to young people that are facing a traumatic experience and need a stable, safe home, whether it's temporary or long-term.
Taking a look at the 2021 Wisconsin Department of Children and Families data, it shows that in Brown and Outagamie counties, where the Oneida Nation lies, Native children are less than 1% of children, but more than 20% of removals. Why is that happening, and how do you think that disproportionate number of child welfare cases involving Native kids should be addressed?
It's really an important issue, especially when it comes to, our communities here in Brown and Outagamie County. Obviously, the city of Green Bay also, sits in Brown County, and Appleton in Outagamie County. And so when you have a larger, metropolitan areas, there are, not just Oneidas that live in this area, but tribes from across the country, have located in these urban areas. And so, there's just a far greater, need to be able to address these issues across even, tribal lines to other tribes as well.
We're talking about the Indian Child Welfare Act, but there's another case that's made headlines this week, the Enbridge issue. This week, a federal judge ordered Enbridge to reroute its pipeline away from tribal land in northern Wisconsin within 3 years. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports that Enbridge is planning to appeal that decision. And of course, Line 5 crosses the Bad River Band of Chippewa land. What's your reaction to that court order?
I think anytime we get a court order action that supports tribes and tribal sovereignty, that's an important action. And so here at Oneida, we've also passed a resolution some time ago in support of the Bad River Lake Superior Chippewa to defend its land and its rights to its resources and to be able to protect them.
The federal judge ordering the reroute of the Enbridge pipeline and the Supreme Court upholding the Indian Child Welfare Act, two court rulings in favor of tribes. How are you feeling right now about how the rights of First Nations are being heard?
Yeah, it definitely ebb and flows with different court decisions, but I think generally overall, the last few years have had some significant victories for tribal nations across the country before the Supreme Court.
What do you think about the future of the Indian Child Welfare Act? I mean, do you see that this is going to continue to be an issue that the courts will grapple with, or is this it? I mean, is this the final word on it for you? I mean, what do you think?
I would definitely hope that it's the final word on challenging ICWA, but the past and history has proven that it's probably not the case, and there's always individuals and parties, I guess, looking to claw back, I guess, any tribal sovereignty that has been long established, and so tribal nations across this country take the importance of defending tribal sovereignty at every turn and wherever possible, because the history that has been federal Indian policy has ebb and flowed back and forth between sovereignty and wards of the state. So there's always these battles, and we expect to continue.
And circling back to the Enbridge case, what do you think the future is there? I mean, do you see that this is going to be tied up for a lot longer? What's going to happen?
Yeah, I definitely see this being tied up a lot longer. As you had mentioned, the likely to appeal. And so, you know, that process takes quite some time, as it did for ICWA. We've been fighting this battle for many years, and then before it got to the Supreme Court. And so if this is on that same track, this could be a battle for several more years before it gets to the Supreme Court, and if they take it up and then the decision. So,
well, I want to thank you for joining us today and sharing your perspective on these issues. This has been a great conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Shereen. Glad I could be here.
Tehasi Hill is the chairman of the Oneida Nation. I'm Shereen Seewert. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.